You are listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Yeah, Lizzie, how you doing?
I'm all right. I've been eating a lot of cakes.
That's what I like to hear from a pro athlete. Loads and loads of cakes.
Yeah, I think our monthly consumption of butter has gone up by 6 times. And yeah, I mean, my husband told me that I would be terrible if we were in a war and we needed rationing. But, you know, we're not in a war. I feel like we're in a battle, not a war. So why not just bake cakes and eat cakes and go for bike rides and burn it off? Seems like a pretty good use of my time.
I am enjoying the Instagram baking. I think baking's become quite popular during the lockdown. I think you were one of the sort of forerunners in the old baking during lockdown game.
One of the pioneers.
Well, there's a danger that we're going to become a baking tech podcast because there's not much riding going around. There's not many bikes that we can see and look at and analyse. But you've been getting out a little bit. I have seen your Instagram. The interesting thing, we were chatting a little bit about this before we started recording, but we should mention it. Like, there is no real defined plan for what pros should be doing during this lockdown because you don't know when you're going to restart. Is what you're doing similar to what your teammates are doing, for instance?
Yeah, I think so. I spoke to some of my teammates the other day and I'm self-coached, so no one tells me what to do, which is quite nice. And so I think early on in this, a lot of people thought that the racing was going to resume a lot earlier than I thought it was. I mean, I've got a bit of a medical background, so I guess I had a little bit of an advantage. But I realised pretty early on it wasn't going to be back on the cards for a little while. So, I mean, in the last episode, you heard me say that I'd injured my knee a bit. So I just had a bit of time off and just chilled out a bit, to be honest, because I didn't want to maintain this really, really high level and have this mental exhaustion. I just thought, I'm going to take a break now. I'm going to take it easy for a bit, bake some cakes, eat some bread, make some curtains, chill with the cats, that kind of thing. And then, I mean, I was still riding like 5 times a week, you know, I'd just maybe have one extra day off and the rides would be less intense and kind of, yeah, just less mentally taxing, I guess. But so now I'm just riding again and I'm doing a lot of endurance riding. I just go for 3-hour rides, so then I don't have to stop anywhere. I'm completely self-sufficient. I've got enough water, I've got enough snacks. And I mean, I'm loving it, to be honest. In the last few days, the weather's been really nice. I've had an easterly wind, so I've been smashing out some QOMs on Strava. And obviously, I don't train just to get loads of QOMs on Strava, but I guess it'll have to do for me for now because it's the only kind of glory I'm going to get for the time being.
I'm going to say, like, I think in the absence of racing, getting QOMs is pretty good, especially, you know, if you're trying to get contracts or, you know, trying to find a team or something. You know, in the end, it's going to be KOMs and QOMs are going to be the only things that sell riders, isn't it? I think
Zwift races and Strava QOMs. Yeah, well, I guess I've got some work to do on the Zwift racing, but I'm pretty high up on the Strava QOM list.
I've got to say I trust the QOMs more than I trust some of the data on Zwift, to be honest.
Have you been making your own segments, Tom? That's what we've got to talk about. No. The ones that finish in your garden.
I started giving up all my KOMs as I wound down my cycling. I've given up loads of them. A couple of them have gone recently.
Really generous of you.
Thanks very much. But anyway, so this week, right, we should just have had the cobbled season. And in the absence of that, we are this week looking at cobbled tech or the lack of it, possibly. And it's great to be joined by you, Lizzie, because you're probably, according to this season, the 6th best cobbled rider in the peloton, I reckon, with your 6 at Omloop.
Yeah, but I think you're forgetting that on my second cobbled day, I crashed and smashed my head on the floor. So maybe let's put it down to 10th. But I guess up there somewhere, it's not too bad. Yeah, I mean, we were supposed to have the cobbled season, but that's not going to stop us looking at the tech. And tech isn't just from 2020. I mean, we've had many, many years of bike racing in the bank that we've got to talk about. And also, tech is so much more than just the race. You know, we've got all the equipment to talk about. Oh, my cat's just come to say hello.
Hello, cat.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've been looking back at some of the tech from the previous races and Later on, Tom's going to work out how he can hook some rock shocks up to his single speed. But yeah, you'll hear a bit more about that later.
Paris-Roubaix, right? Paris-Roubaix, which should have just happened last weekend. My favourite race, hands down. I love going to it. We're going to talk a lot about it later on. But when we were chatting before, it's a bit of a blind spot for you. And is that just because there's no women's edition?
Yeah, kind of. So, I mean, I'm relatively new to cycling, and kind of the first time that I became a cycling fan was when the Tour de Yorkshire came through my hometown Sheffield in 2014. And that was the first kind of time I'd ever had anything to do with professional cycling. And so I then started racing in 2015, but I still didn't really understand anything about cycling at all. And I got into watching Orica Green Edge, as was their backstage pass films, which were awesome. And I think it was 2016 when Matt Heyman won, and I watched that episode of Backstage Pass, which, if you haven't seen it, is epic. You have to watch it. It's just the most inspiring film ever. So I watched that, and I guess that was the first time that I really learned about Paris-Roubaix and what this race was. But I think I still didn't quite understand how big it is. And obviously the lack of a women's race, and, you know, I have so many other epic women's races to focus on, meant that I guess it's never kind of stood on a pedestal for me like it does for some people. But it's interesting as well, because there was this great advert that Specialized did last year with Anna van der Breggen, last year's world champion, Chantal van der Breggen Black, the previous year's world champion, Christine Madjerus, multiple time Luxembourg national champion. And they did an ad on their Specialized Roubaix on the famed cobblestones in the forest of Arenberg, saying, "This bike isn't just for men. The race shouldn't be either." So, you know, maybe in the future we'll have a race and then we can do another episode then. And then my Paris-Roubaix knowledge will be just as good as yours. Maybe not historically, but presently.
One last question then before we get on to some real serious tech. You were sixth in Omloop. I was joking about it before, but, you know, you were sixth in Omloop this year. And that was an amazing result. And we saw you, you know, really fighting up those cobble climbs. How do you... knowing where we live, there aren't that many cobbles. I can think of a cobbled hill over in Cheshire that's probably just
Swiss
at
hill.
The edge of where you can get to on a ride. Swiss Hill, yeah, a horrific climb. But how do you prepare for cobbles as someone who lives in this country?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just about replicating the action of riding on the cobbles. It's replicating the kind of riding that you're going to be doing. So when you're on the cobbles, you sit back, you sit in the handlebars, you push, and you generally push a slightly lower gear. So if you've done a lot of strength work over winter, you can ride the climbs and you can just push like almost as if you were on cobbles. Okay, yeah, you can't replicate that kind of bone jarring sensation that you get from them, but you can replicate the effort, and that's the main thing. I do a lot of gravel riding actually because I love it. Maybe not so much in winter because it's so, you know, dirty and muddy, but that's helpful, you know, because you get the feeling of sliding around a little bit and being slightly less sure of what you're doing, but being sure about being unsure, if that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, you can definitely replicate it. It's about strength, and if you've got the strength and you've got the fitness, then as long as you don't try and ride in, you know, a tiny gear with your legs spinning, you'll be fine.
So one thing I always think that sort of innovation around riding on the cobbles has been pretty thin on the ground, especially if you look at cycling as a sport on the whole, you know, over the decades it's been around. But one thing that everyone knows is that the right tyre choice is absolutely vital.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how many teams can and their bike partners can actually afford the investment of creating a whole new commercially available bike product just so that the professionals can ride it for one race a year? Okay, right, we've got Team Sky, Ineos. You know, they had their K8. Last year it was the new model, the FS, that had both front and rear suspension. But, I mean, the biggest thing and the cheapest thing that you can do that's going to make the biggest difference is your tyres. So I sat down with Tommaso Capella from Vittoria Tires to talk about the evolution from skinny tires to the big fat ones that we use today.
Yeah, usually Roubaix is the terrain for 30 millimeter tires. So we are used to race tubulars. tubulars are coming from the gold age of cycling, you know, beginning of last century, 20th century. So tubular hasn't changed much. What we have seen on tubular improvement over the years, over the decades, is the sizing and then casing construction and tread technology, like compounds with some special material like graphene, which Victoria used for a couple of years with great success. And so back in the 90s, you know, when we had steel frames made specially to absorb impacts on the cobbles at Roubaix, I think at that time they used to ride 19 or 25, maybe up to 23 millimeter tubulars. Nowadays we use 23 millimeter tubulars only on track racing. And yeah, it may happen that some rider goes on 30 millimeter tubulars on those cobbles. It's quite common to have 28 millimeter tire on everyday race. For sure, everyone is racing on 25 millimeter tubulars.
So how would a pro go about deciding whether to use a clincher, a tubular, or a tubeless tire?
That's an interesting question, because, okay, clincher, I've had some tentative back in time on racing, but it's not really the best for racing because rolling resistance is not ideal. Tubular reduce the rolling resistance on racing and enhance comfort. You know, it's kind of traditional way. The tradition of racing is tubular. Nowadays we are seeing a bit more tubeless here and there, and I wouldn't expect that a couple of years ago, but last year we had a couple of riders testing tubeless on Roubaix because they felt really confident, because the rolling performance, like rolling resistance, is lower than any other tire. I must say that to compare apple with apples, we want to compare cotton tires with cotton tires, so cotton tubulars with cotton tubeless. And so yeah, it's going to happen that we might see some tubeless on the cobbles of Roubaix. For sure we will see more tubeless on the racing. Yeah, let's say we make two big differences between nylon tires and cotton tires. So our top range are the cotton tires, which we make in three different models. The Corsa Speed, which is known to be the fastest tire because it's like, as the name says, is meant for time trial or super fast racing. Then we have the Corsa and Corsa Control, which are actually, Corsa would be the best all-round tire and Corsa Control the one for more tough terrains or those difficult days on wet and cobbles.
So you would see, put them probably heading towards the Corsa Controls and something like Roubaix, do you think?
Yeah, that would be the main choice. I would expect also someone to get the risk and race on Corsas, large volume, that means 28 millimeters, 30 millimeters on cobbles, because there the volume makes the comfort and the rolling performance as well. So I think we are going to see some change on those kind of races where we have mixed terrain, tarmac and cobbles. And we may see some new technologies approaching the cycling, like the traditional cycling, because we would like to have more comfort on the cobbles and less rolling resistance on the tarmac. So yeah, it's too early to say what's going to happen, but yeah, let's keep our eyes open there.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and Service Course. You can get 25% off your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. Science in Sport launched a new product this week, a performance nitrate range formulated to deliver effective doses of dietary nitrates to support loading, pre-exercise and intra-exercise usage. The key performance benefit is that nitrates improve muscle efficiency by reducing the oxygen cost of exercise and maximising endurance performance, enabling athletes to go harder for longer. The SIS Performance Nitrate range includes gels, bars, powders, shots, and use rhubarb juice concentrate and amaranthus leaf extract as unique sources of nitrates, providing a superior taste profile and delivering a higher nitrate dose compared to anything else on the market. Supplementing with nitrates can improve running economy or cycling efficiency by reducing the oxygen cost of exercise. For more information on the performance nitrate range, see scienceinsport.com. And remember, you can get 25% off your Science in Sport order with the code SISCP25. So, Lizzie, over the years, what sort of tyres have you used? And do you have... I mean, you probably have a sponsor, so you're probably limited in what you can say. But do you have a favourite type of tyre? You know, would you rather use a clincher than, say, a tubeless or a tubular? What do you prefer?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, when I first started cycling, I think it was quite funny because people would say, oh, yeah, these tyres feel amazing. I'd watch this on videos and I think, or read it on the web and think, oh, you know, what are people talking about? And I think it's the same thing. In the old days, I used to see people using knee warmers and I thought, why the hell are you using knee warmers? What's the point? And then I started using knee warmers and I thought, oh, knee warmers are awesome. And it's the same with tyres. Like, I just used rubbish tyres. And then I bought a pair, I think the first semi-decent pair I bought was Continental GP4000s. And then I was like, oh, these are great. And then I started using better and better tyres. And each time I went onto a better set of tyres, I could feel the difference and it felt amazing. And our team's supported by Vittoria and Vittoria tyres are great. But there is a difference between, you know, the training tyres that you've got on your road bike and the race tyres that we use. And that feeling that you have when you get on a race tyre, it's amazing. Like, I get on my race bike and for all intents and purposes, it's the same as my training bike at home. Okay, it's a bit cleaner. The bearings are a little bit better greased, not full of mud. But it's the same bike. And I get on it and you just feel like you're flying because it's the tyre. It's the tyre that's doing the talking and it's the tyre that makes you feel like that. Everything else is the same. Anyway, the feeling of speed is a really funny thing. And here's what Tommaso had to say about it.
I mean, the feel of speed is something that's really confusing because we feel more speed when we go not that fast on a not fast solution, like a small car or a nylon tire, which is harsh and makes you feel going fast. But if you're riding on a supercar or a cotton tire, you don't feel that harshness, that, you know, the struggle of the speed. So you don't feel that much speed, but actually are going faster.
Okay, right. So, Lizzie, it's 2021? No, it's 2022, right? There is a women's
There is a women's... Add one extra
There's no global pandemic.
There. Yeah, okay, good. Right, we've sorted that. Wonderful.
There are no global pandemics, and there is now a women's Paris-Roubaix. You're setting up your bike. What are you using?
Okay, well, first of all, I would have a disc brake bike because it could be wet. And if it's wet, I want to be able to stop. I would also definitely have a bike with a frame with an aero component, aero kind of aspect to it, because it's a flat race. I want to be fast, maybe kind of a more cyclocrossy type setup, but I still want it to be racy and feel like my race bike. But most importantly, I would use a wide width wheel with a wider tire, probably a Corsa if I was still with Vittoria, and I would take the risk on like not having something with a bit more puncture protection, but I would definitely go tubeless. Probably not what you would use though, Tom, is it?
Before we get into what I would use, why tubeless? What's the thinking?
You need to continue listening to the podcast and I will tell you why later.
Okay, well, listen, I have been studying historic Paris-Roubaix. Take a listen.
We zijn in de buurt van Hem en dat is zo'n kilometer of vijf voor Roubaix. Van wie Henny Kuiper de enige is die Paris-Roubaix nog niet gewonnen heeft. Voorzitter Vlaming, winnaar in 72, 74, 75 en 77. Francesco Moser, winnaar vorig jaar, twee keer tweede, één keer derde. En Mark de Meijer, winnaar in 1976. Dat zijn de mannen die hier op kop rijden. En Henny Kuiper is de enige die, ondanks een paar ereplaatsen in deze wedstrijd, nog niet...
So Paris-Roubaix is hands down my favourite race of the season, and the race that this year I'll be missing the most. when I lived in London, I used to love getting on the Eurostar early on a Sunday morning, getting out of the metro station in Roubaix and walking through the deserted town, where it is only on the approach to the velodrome that you get the sensation that a major sporting event is going to be happening here in a few hours' time. In the absence of racing, the computer game variety aside, I've been watching old editions of Roubaix and looking to see how the bikes were set up to deal with the cobbles. And like today, they don't really seem to make any major adjustments.
In the 90s, when everyone was thinking about, you know, putting in shocks and that, and then it went back, sort of later in the 90s, it went back to being very, very much, you know, slightly larger tyres, possibly a bit of padding around the handlebars, possibly slightly larger inside chain rings. It's kind of gone back to that more recently. So it's not the technology. When you talk to riders, there really isn't much that's actually very special about this technology from the 70s, partly because they didn't really do innovative technology at that time for those sort of races, and in general they didn't do it, but also because, you know, they just didn't sort of conceive it in that way.
That's William Fotheringham, author of A Sunday in Hell, a brilliant book that tells the story of the film of the same name from 1976 by Jürgen Leth.
It's the afternoon of Saturday the 10th of April. Roger de Vlaeminck arrives at the Brooklyn team's hotel in Lamallée, north of Paris. His teammates and the team personnel are already there to meet him.
Yeah, so what makes him look so special is the fact that Jürgen uses all these different camera angles. So obviously we're not used to seeing that much different, varied camera work when it comes to races from the 1970s. His use of the West Cam on the helicopter is a first for bike racing, so that's completely new, that's completely novel. You know, it's visually, that's why it's so spectacular compared to other races of the time and, you know, races of the day.
Now, other than tyre pressure, maybe a change of saddle and an extra bit of bar tape, it's clear that in the 76th edition of the race, there are no really specific bits of Roubaix kit, maybe a cross bike here or there. But we do learn from that film a lot about the role that mechanics played.
One of the things we all notice when we watch it is those mechanics doing this mad thing of perching on the roof of the cars. And obviously health and safety stopped that in the 80s sometime. But the why of it is very interesting because it's about getting the riders' wheels quickly. But God, if you tell me this, that it's not just about getting the wheels quickly, it's about making the changes very, very rapidly so that as a team car you maintain your place in the convoy, because that's almost more important than getting the wheels to everybody apart from the team leader. So you say, you know, you're number four at Brooklyn punctures, yeah, you want to get the wheel quick, but what you want to be doing is you want to be right up there at the front of that convoy, not losing position. Because getting back through the detritus of the fallen riders, the cars stopping here, there, and everywhere, is so difficult. So that's why mechanics try and make these really fast changes, so that they're there when it really, really matters for the likes of Vlaeminck and Godefroot and Merckx.
It wasn't really until the 1990s that we really saw attempts to beat the cobbles with specific bike designs.
Good position here then for Plancard to be on Wamper's wheel as they begin to wind it up now. Box down the inside, Gaillon, and up at the top. Bauer starts to go, but it's the blue colours from behind. Van Hooydonk is beginning to release an enormous fast sprint. He's gone for the long one. He's swept past them. Bauer can't hold his wheel. Can Bauer close up on him as Van Hooydonk heads down toward the finishing straight? And look at Plancard go over the top. He's gone straight to the top of the bank. He's zooming down, but Bauer's in the lead. Bauer's going for it, pushing those pedals, and he's rushing for the line. He throws his bike at it. Oh, I don't know whether Bauer or Plancard got that one. It was so, so close. We shall have to have a photo finish for that one.
In 1990, Steve Bauer finished second in a thrilling edition of the race. You can hear more about that in a previous episode of the Cycling Podcast from a couple of weeks ago. And he was riding a bike that was equal parts startling and hideous, but it worked.
I tried this really, you know, kind of wonky position. One gentleman in Belgium had seen or sort of reviewed a position that a cyclotourist was using into very, very beneficial strength position, like, which was far back and, you know, use your hamstrings a lot more and the wheelbase is a lot longer. So it sort of really, really changes your attack on the crank system, which allows you to have more power through the hamstring and maybe an extended stroke. And for Roubaix, it was actually quite good because the wheelbase of the bike was long and very comfortable, more like a Cadillac.
The bike itself is this long wheelbase and a seat tube that slopes back at what looks like about 45 degrees from the bottom bracket. I have to assume that it would be illegal now. If not, it should be on purely aesthetic grounds. It's hideous.
The difficulty is in acceleration and standing was less versatile, but it was a very powerful position while seated. You know, that's what I mentioned before, the limitations of kind of a one-way street. You know, seated, you know, on cobbles was like, you know, felt like a Cadillac in a very, very powerful position. But, you know, accelerating out of turns or climbing, sprinting, it had its, you know, severe limitations.
Now we come on to a true innovation that helped win the race on three consecutive occasions, starting in 1992. And that innovation was RockShox.
Don't try this on any other bike. Hercules RockShox FSD with front and rear shock absorbers.
That advert was actually from 1997, when RockShox had left road cycling behind to focus on mountain biking. But in 92, 93 and 94, road bikes equipped with RockShox front suspension were ridden to Paris-Roubaix victories. In 92, the race was won by Gilbert Duclos-Lassalle. And he won it again in 93 to become the oldest ever winner of the race. In 94, his race was disrupted by a puncture.
He just cannot get enough grip at all, and he's sliding over the plate, and up in front, it looks like Duclos-Lassalle is selling out, and Duclos-Lassalle's got trouble! He's punctured as well!
But it was won by André Schmill, who was also riding RockShox. A bike with not just front suspension, but full suspension may even have won that 94 edition. But after making the final break, Johan Mousseau had a mechanical which robbed him of a potential victory. Just as well as that bike is also a monstrosity. It caused a real stir at the start in Compiègne, where the Lion of Flanders' bike was surrounded by a scrum of cycling fans and journalists. So how come the wildly successful innovation of suspension didn't catch on? For the Bianchi that Mousseau rode, that probably has something to do with it costing 20 grand to produce. And remember, that was in 1994. In the end, that bike was only ever raced once. Another reason is that classic feature of cycling, the desire to maintain the purity of the sport. Following 94, five of the next six editions of Paris-Roubaix would be won by the MAPEI team, whose bike sponsor, Ernesto Colnago, banned his teams from using the RockShox product, as did fellow Italian frame maker Ugo De Rosa. A potential reason why the idea has not been revisited more recently is the UCI rule that forbids brands from producing one-off bikes for pro riders, meaning they have to be commercially available and thus commercially viable. And I don't know if the market is ready for a full suspension road bike. Rob Hales rode Paris-Roubaix three times, in 2001, 2002, the last wet edition, and 2003. But he didn't finish on any occasion, and that's not surprising when you consider his team, Cofidis, and their attitude towards equipment.
2001, it was kind of a last minute, it was only a couple of weeks before where they selected me for it. Basically, I was lucky in as much as there was some illness and injury at that point, which most teams do. So I ended up riding three-day to Panna, Tour of Flanders, Gent-Wevelgem and Paris-Roubaix. So I stayed on for that extra block, which is not bad. First year pro, I was pretty chuffed with that. But of course, they were all riding cyclocross bikes, which everyone had made for them. I didn't have one, again, because I was last minute. So I came down on the Thursday morning. We did, back then, it was Flanders, then Gent-Wevelgem on the Wednesday, and then we went straight down to Compiègne to do the reconnaissance and all that. And I've come down and I'm looking at all the bikes and I'm seeing all the name tags on them. And I'm looking, there's this one bike that a mechanic's working on. I thought, that's my bike. Like, no way, that can't be mine. Anyway, it was from the year before, Francis Moreau, who's no longer on the team. It was his cross bike. And I went, où est mon vélo? And he's going, oh, c'est là. You know, here it is. So anyway, I got a tape measure out and I just measured from the tip of the saddle to the bars, and it was about 6 centimetres too short. So he got a 6mm Allen key, he undid the saddle, and the nose of the saddle, he just went bang, and slammed it as far back on the rails as it would go. Nipped it up, stood back, put his arms out and went, voila. That was it.
Perhaps that underlines another reason why Paris-Roubaix and the cobbled classics haven't sparked the innovation you might expect. A lot of teams in the past just didn't take this sort of thing seriously. Of course, those days are gone, and we've seen the Pinarello KAS with its suspension unit at the top of the seats days, but that bike is still an outlier. But why try and make riding the cobbles easier? Maybe there's more fun to be had making it harder. Answer, there definitely isn't.
Well, you know how it is, Tom. You're out on a ride, and you get these stupid ideas. And that was one of them. It was a wonderful experience, but it was still a stupid idea, I say.
This is Garrett Tarbert, who rode the Roubaix course on his single speed. He came up with the idea on his daily commute from north to east London.
It's 27 kilometres each way, and a good deal of it was down along the River Lee. Really bumpy, really rough. And I was thinking to myself, you know what, I'm riding a single speed steel bike, weighs about 11 kilos down this trail. I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm just like the old school kind of Paris-Roubaix classics riders. You know, couldn't have been further from the truth, obviously, but, you know, you like to play these games in your head. And I posted a picture online, I think it was on Twitter, of one of my rides. The guys from Quella responded. We started talking. I put the idea together, pitched it to them and said, you know, how about this on one of your bikes? And they liked the idea, and it went from there. And then once I'd said it to them and they were on board, then I was committed. I had to do it.
Now, obviously, Garrett did make some accommodations for the cobbles.
Well, the main changes were, as you'd expect, the wheels. I knew that, I'd need a pretty strong wheel, but also something that was a bit more kind of compliant than, maybe the deep section wheels that you often see on a fixed gear bike. I wanted something that had more of a rounded profile and essentially a bit more flex in the wheel. So I got in touch with a guy called Pete Matthews, who's kind of a master wheel builder up in Liverpool. And he put together a set of absolutely bomb-proof 32-spoke wheels for me. I laced them up with, 32 spokes, really, really heavy-duty spokes on them, and then put some 28mm tyres on there. So, you know, on the road, I might use a 23 or a 25, depending on the course. For the Roubaix, it was a 28, so I could run them at about kind of 45, 50 PSI, which, you know, just gave me a more comfortable ride. The other thing I did, I put a ridiculously comfortable saddle on there. It's actually a saddle I had on a mountain bike in the late 90s. And I've done thousands of kilometers on this thing. And I knew that, you know, my bum was going to be taking a bit of a pounding over the cobbles. So that's the saddle I opted for.
Garrett normally rides a fixed gear because he had a motorbike accident, which left him with limited movement in one of his hands. And so trouble squeezing the brakes. But as I mentioned, he rode Roubaix on a single speed rather than a fixed gear, although I have seen that done by a bunch of French riders, and I'll post a link to that film in the show notes. It was something I considered trying myself a few years ago. Not anymore. Now, obviously, Garrett's experience was awful, but I'll let him tell you that in his own words.
You know, I've been riding bikes since I was 7. I did Roubaix when I was 38, and in all those years, it was the first time whilst during any kind of event that I got off my bike and said to myself, why am I here? You know, what am I doing? It was in the middle of one of the longer cobble sections, like a 3.5 kilometer section of cobbles. And, you know, you have to slow right down in the bends to a virtual stop anyway, because, you know, on this particular day, they were super dusty and, the dust could easily make your front wheel slide out. So you're slowing right down. I got around this corner, and ideally, you should stomp on the pedals, get your speed back up. And I just suddenly deflated completely and was kind of like, why is this happening? I'd been on the bike already for about 4 hours by this point. So I stood at the side of the road, you know, with my bike kind of, you know, in my hands for maybe about, it felt like an eternity. It was probably only about 20 or 30 seconds. Gave myself a quick talking to, got back on the bike. And actually, my mood really lifted after that, because that was like, you know, the lowest point, and got back on, and I cracked on with it. But it was just, it wasn't my legs, it wasn't even my arms or my hands, it was my lower back. It was that pounding going up through your body all the time. And, you know, you're hunched over the bars, you can't really relax. And yeah, it's just relentless. It's really relentless. And, you know, I would say it's harder than 24-hour ultramarathons that I've run. It's harder than any triathlon I've done. It's just, as I say, it is just relentless, just the constant beating you get. I think the funniest experience, though, came the next morning when my wife and my daughter came over to be with me at the end, and we spent a day just driving up to Belgium the next day. And my daughter was sitting in the bed beside me the next morning, and I was too sore to eat my own breakfast. You know, she was trying to feed me a croissant or something, and she found it hilarious, and I was just in absolute agony. You know, it took me about 2 hours to get moving the next morning.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That said, PK, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, interrupting this episode of Service Course with Tom and Lizzie to remind me, Richard Moore, to tell you that this month's episode is sponsored by the Friends of the Cycling Podcast. The Cycling Podcast, as many of you will know, is an independent media company. We rely on sponsors, advertisers, and you, the listener. If you are a friend of the podcast, you are also a valued sponsor of the Cycling Podcast, and you help us to produce the regular weekly show, our daily coverage from the Grand Tours, Mitch Docker's fortnightly life in the Peloton, and our monthly shows, the Cycling Podcast Femina, Explore, and of course, Service Course. As a friend of the podcast, you also get exclusive friend specials, in-depth episodes including our audio diaries from the Grand Tours, the story of the stage that didn't end, that's stage 19 of last year's Tour de France, and our most recent special on the Dutch phenomenon Mathieu van der Poel. There are also some older shows in the current feed, so if you sign up now, you will get our look back on arguably the best team of this century, HTC High Road, Matt Heyman reliving his 2016 Paris-Roubaix win, meeting Jean Bobet, an interview with the 1950s star, and the Lionel of the Ardennes, Lionel Burney's excursion last year along Belgian cycling's less well-travelled road. Friends of the podcast can also now access old episodes of Kilometre Zero from the Grand Tours. Any episodes from 2018 or before are on our new Kilometre Zero feed, available only to friends of the podcast. To support the Cycling Podcast by becoming a friend, go to thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe. It's £15 for a year's membership, but there are options to pay a bit extra, and if you do, you will get a signed copy of our latest book, The Grand Tour Diaries, delivered to your door.
Have you had a chance to look at any of those old suspension bikes at Roubaix?
No, I'm going to look now. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we should start with that.
Oh, my God. Is that the one? What's this one with a... There's one with like a kind of full sus bit at the bottom. Surely that's not legit.
That is the one. Yeah, so while that package was playing, I got Lizzie to Google Yamuso's 94... Bianchi from Paris-Roubaix.
Hold on, Tom,
if you haven't seen it, it's worth
it. I don't think this is real. I think I'm on a fake site here. It can't be real.
No, I mean, it was real. It was legal. It was only raced that once. It's a full suspension Bianchi. And genuinely, he could have won that race. The myth goes that he was so angry that his bike let him down, his equipment failed. But actually, I think the story was that it was actually a puncture that let him down. This is why I think, you know, cobbles should inspire more innovation. Oh, that bike is absolutely hideous, right?
It's the worst thing I've ever seen.
But in any other sport, you know, we would be looking to solve the conundrum of the cobbles. And I think cycling has this just level of purity. And we know that, you know, events tend to be quite traditional and stuff like that. There's this level of purity in cycling that means maybe we don't innovate as much as we could. I think things are changing, but that's my thesis anyway.
I think you're right. I think that the more hardcore you are, the more pain you put up with it with. But anyway, from old school to new school. Now, we know that tubeless is coming, and it's been coming for a long time. In fact, it's been here for a while now. Vittoria already produced an airliner, which is kind of like a run flat system for their mountain bike tires. And it allows you to keep rolling if you get a flat. Well, Tommaso couldn't tell me all the details about the impending release of this new product because it was too secretive. But this is what he did tell us.
So we introduced the airliner. That's what we call our insert, a couple of years ago on a mountain bike. And it's not a secret that we are working on expanding on all ranges, like rubber, cyclocross, road, wherever there's a tubeless tire, we want to be safe and sure that if we got a flat tire, we don't see the tire coming off the rim. So we want to be safe. And at the same time, what we've done in the mountain bike, along with safety, we enhanced a little bit the driving performance and predictability of the bike. So sorry, I'm too early to say it loud, but yeah, there's something coming in the next couple of months. And that would be, I'm curious to see how much it will change racing, but for sure something will change at that time.
So a run flat system, is that, I mean, this goes without saying, right? But that's definitely something that would appeal to you, right?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think, so if you get a puncture in a race and you're on a tubular wheel, you're pretty screwed. Like, yeah, you might have a slow puncture, but the likelihood is if you puncture, it's just going to go bang straight down. And you can roll for a little bit, but not on the cobbles. If you roll on the cobbles, you're just going to smash your rim to bits. So the idea of a run flat system is that you puncture, but you've still got a couple of bar in the tire. And so it allows you to roll through and you can, okay, yeah, it's going to be a little bit more hard work, but you can keep rolling and you can get to the end of that sector where your Swanee's there with wheels. You don't have to wait for a car, because you know what it's like in Paris-Roubaix, it's absolute carnage. Like, you could be waiting 20 minutes for a car because they're just stuck behind everything. So yeah, it allows you to keep rolling and keep moving. And that is the way that you can save your race if you puncture.
Well, Paris-Roubaix has got to be the race where you're most likely to puncture, but equally the race above all others where a puncture can cost you massively. With that in mind, NTT Pro Cycling headed out to the cobbles in February to put all their equipment to the test. Here's Neil Shirley, who was there representing Envy, to tell us how it went.
Yeah, so I went over to northern France the second week of February with NTT Pro Cycling. Edvald Bosenhagen and Michael Gogol were the two team riders. In addition to Vittoria was there for tires, and BMC was there for as the bike partner. And it was really, it was two long days spent on the cobbles of Paris-Roubaix to really find out what the best equipment was going to be for race day for the riders, for the protected riders. So it was really, BMC had four different bike models there. Vittoria had multiple tires in tubeless and in tubular. I was there for Envy, so we had a number of different wheels, tubular and tubeless, in different depths for the riders to test. And, you know, the riders had not spent, well, they had very limited experience on tubeless, so that was one of the big objectives, is just getting them on tubeless over the cobbles and, you know, the back-to-back testing between the tubeless and the tubular ended up being quite eye-opening.
Can you describe how the testing process actually worked?
Yeah, so the riders, they went out. We were on two different sectors of cobbles, and they had a loop, about a 2.5 kilometer loop they were doing, between one and one and a half kilometers of cobbles, and then some smooth pavement to connect back. So it was the riders going out, doing lap after lap after lap. Each lap, they would either, there's a protocol for, you know, which wheel model or bike model they were going to. Well, it first started with bikes, and then they kind of really settled on what the preferred frame model was going to be. And then they went back and forth with tubeless to tubular, kind of finally got to the point that they settled on what they liked there. And then it went to tire pressure and finding that optimal tire pressure. So it was kind of the steps, so that not everything was thrown at them at one point. They would kind of finalize one thing and move on to the next, until by the end of the second day, they really had a lot of confidence in their final setup.
My knowledge of tire pressure, Lizzie, has probably expanded exponentially since I got a gravel bike.
other than that, it was always just, you know, pump it up to about 100 PSI and ride as fast as you can. But, you know, having a gravel bike has taught me about the different variations I need depending on the weather, depending on the conditions, depending on where I'm going to be riding. And the trends in terms of tire pressure have changed over time. I think it was Alberto Contador who went against the grain, and he was talking about riding, I think it was cobbles, and he was on about having really high tire pressure, which is completely against the thinking nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just crazy the kind of pressures people used to run, and even the kind of pressures I used to run a couple of years ago, because it's just what people did. And even still, a lot of mechanics on a lot of teams put way too much air in the tyres, especially on wet days. And like, if you've got someone on time trial, you just see people just going flying everywhere because they've just got too much air in them. And yeah, I mean, I run kind of 70, 80 PSI on my 25 millimetre wheels just for training. And so many people would think, oh my gosh, that's so low. But actually, yeah, it's plenty, and you get a really nice ride quality. And actually, you don't get a decrease in the rolling resistance until you go pretty low. So you can actually go much, much lower than you think without having any negative effect at all. This is what Neil Shirley had to say about the NTT riders and how they selected the best tyre pressure for them and for Paris-Roubaix.
I think that most people really don't experiment with tyre pressure and don't realise the impact it truly has on the ride quality. And so tire pressure was something that we spent hours and hours on. And it started out for both tubular and tubeless, but once we had kind of once the riders had realized the difference in ride quality with tubeless and ride quality that they preferred, especially in terms of efficiency on the smoother pavement sections, that's when we really started refining the tire pressure. And it went from, I think we started almost as high as 70 PSI. And my apologies for not having the bar equivalent right in front of me, but I'll have to go with PSI. And so it was almost 70 PSI. And what we ended up doing is continuing to drop down lower and lower until we got to the point where the riders felt that they were losing that efficient feel on the pavement. So we went as low as just slightly below 40 PSI in the tubeless setup. And it was Ed Vald who was like, okay, I found the point. We need to go back up a little bit more. And what the riders achieved was an efficient feel on the pavement more so than the tubular, whereas they kind of got that perfect tire pressure so that on the cobbles they had, I'm not going to say a comfortable ride, because anyone that's ridden the cobbles knows that there's no such thing as that, but something that they could manage on the cobbles and then yet still an efficient feel on the pavement.
We're going to go on to talk about rim widths here, Lizzie. Rims have become my particular bugbear at the moment, because a lot of rims these days are coming tubeless ready. So if you want to put a nice set of clinchers on, it is I've literally had to take my bike to the bike shop and get a couple of us to put a tyre on a tubeless rim, on a tubeless ready rim. And then you just think, well, what's going to happen to me if I'm out and about and I get a puncture? You know, I'm just going to need to call the AA or something. Do you know what I mean?
I feel your pain. Rims, I feel your big pain problem. And I echo your sentiment, because I have been doing a lot of gravel riding over the past couple of weeks, and my puncture rate has gone up from one per year to two a week. And I have tubeless ready rims, and they are a blinking nightmare. And the first puncture I had, thank God I was with Gabriel, because I, like, for the love of God, I could not get it on. But anyway, I was the most stupid idiot, and I didn't have inner tubes with long enough valve stems for my wheels, did I? So I couldn't get the blimmin' cartridge on my wheel, and I got about 10 PSI in my wheel, and I, like, it was so little that I was having to put all my weight over the front wheel, and I couldn't put my weight over the back wheel. And this was during the coronavirus thing, so I couldn't even just go to somebody's house. I actually asked someone on the street in Hathersage if I could borrow their pump, and they kindly, like, gave it to me from a distance, and I tried, but I couldn't get it on. Anyway, so I thought, oh, I'm screwed. But thankfully, I had another inner tube, which is fine, and it had a long enough valve stem, but it took me about half an hour to get the tyre on and off. Since then, as I said, I've been doing a lot of gravel riding. I've had about 7 more punctures. So my tyre has actually loosened a bit. But my teammates have got some tips. They say you can put a little bit of grease on it. And I guess if you're out in the field, just like take a bit of grease from your chain and like, or, you know, rub it on the inside of your rims. And the trick is that you have to pump it up really, really high to make it pop into the rims. But I appreciate that's really difficult when you're out in the field. So the best thing to do is to carry some CO2 cartridges with the correct length fat inner tubes. That helps. And then that allows you to inflate it enough so that it pops onto the rims, and then you can deflate it a little bit.
Anyway, listen, I'm going to go down a rabbit hole of moaning about rims now. Let's talk about rims in a different way.
Well, I understand your pain about tubeless wheels, Tom, but there is a trend towards tubeless wheels. It's what the consumers want. The consumers want awesome adventure gravel bikes, and they don't want a puncture. And that's what's going to happen if you have tubeless. So with that trend of tubeless, there's also a trend of wider rims. So the Envy wheels that the NTT guys were using, they've actually got a 25mm rim bed width. And okay, maybe that doesn't sound like anything or mean anything to you, but their standard wheels were 20 or 21 millimetres, and they were classed as a pretty wide wheel. So these 25mm ones are super wide. And the thing is that's really important is you've got to get the right width tyre on there. So these guys ended up mounting a 28mm tyre onto a 25mm rim. But once you measure it up, it actually measures up as a 30.5mm tyre. So what happens when you don't get that critical choice of tyre and rim right? Here's Tommaso again to tell us what happened in last year's Roubaix.
We've seen last year a couple of stories like that. I mean, in one side was, a wrong choice driven by a very good feeling of the product. So there were a couple of riders in a couple of teams testing tubeless, and they felt so confident about the rolling resistance and the comfort and the no compromise of rolling resistance on the tarmac and comfort on cobbles. So we had a couple of riders riding on the Roubaix race with skinny tires, such as 25mm tires on deep section rims. And yeah, they were willing for a podium at least, and they came out with a couple of flat tires because of the tire burping on the cobbles. But again, they didn't get out of the bike in the cobble section. You know, they could ride all the way through the cobbles. And that was a great success on the product side. And what was amazing to hear at the end of the race, that one of those riders said, "I had the best flat tire ever," which sounds weird, but a good success to me.
Well, I've been pretty curious about tubeless for a while now. My brother, who used to be a professional trials rider, has been telling me for years, "I don't understand why you're not using tubeless." And I have to say, I agree with him. So I spoke to Neil about what the benefits of tubeless are to the consumer.
You know, if you're out on a training ride and you get a flat tire, that it's just like fixing a flat tire and a clincher setup. You can just, you know, pop the side of the bead off the tire and remove the valve stem out of the rim and throw an inner tube in and, you know, air it up and be back on your way, you know, finishing your training ride. It's not as complex as I think sometimes it seems. And I think really, you know, the pro riders feel that tubeless is an advantage, and they're looking at it as rolling resistance and, you know, reducing watts and that. But really the consumer stands to benefit the most, and that's, you know, running sealant in your tubeless. So you have fewer flat tires, running a better tire pressure without worry of pinch flatting. Kind of some of the, in addition to lower rolling resistance, but I would say not having to manage flat tires out on the open road is something like, that's what I personally love about the system.
Well, there you go. Sold. We should all be running tubeless. I think we know that anyway. Like I say, I'm a total convert since I had them on my gravel bike. Absolutely game changing. And I don't know if it's a quirk or anything, but there's something that feels a little bit more comfortable about them. Maybe something feels fast about them on the road as well. I'm not sure if that's just my mind playing tricks on me, but I do. The sensation of running tubeless, I do really like.
Well, it was that quirk about the feeling of speed that Tommaso was talking about earlier. I mean, it's something that's so funny, isn't it? You can feel so fast, but actually you can be quite slow. And I'm not saying that you're slow, Tom.
I used to be fast. Honestly, Liz, you saw me once. I was quite fast.
You were pretty fast.
Before I had a toddler.
You were sitting on the wheel.
Before I had a toddler. Oh. Well, my next ride... you have been encouraging me to get outside, and I am actually going to start getting back on the road, I think. I've been doing all my riding on Zwift since the lockdown, and probably even before the lockdown. But my next ride, and you're going to join us for this. Last week was the inaugural cycling podcast No Drop Cappuccino ride. But there's another one of those on Sunday, so you're going to join us for that, aren't you, Lizzie?
I am going to join you, but I have to say it's 10 a.m. It's a little bit early for me, so I might be turning the cranks with my hand and eating my breakfast and having my cup of tea at the same time, or maybe I'll just put Gabriel on there for me. But no, I'll join you, and we're going to have a nice social ride, and I'll bring the cake.
It's great, and we are going to try and expand this as well, so more and more of you can join the rides. One of the tech innovations that I've made recently is that I've established Cycling Podcast Race Radio using an app called Discord, so we can all chat to each other while we're on our respective turbos around the country. I demoed it last week. I'm going to play out with a little bit of our chat and our waffle. This took a lot of editing, by the way. Blimey, there was some rubbish. But because we're all Luddites when it comes to technology, when we were setting this up on WhatsApp and chatting about it, there was quite a lot of jokes about how do I get this to work on my Mega Drive or my Game Boy. So there is some very 16-bit music to this package. If you can name what game it's from, let me know on Twitter. No prizes, but you will get some very good nerd points. Lizzie, thanks ever so much.
Thanks, Tom. I'll see you at the cafe ride.
Rob, are you going to comment? Are you going to commentate this?
No.
Go on.
He's got his Preston voice on. He can't convert it back.
This is a lot more stressful than just sitting in front of Netflix watching Tiger
Lionel.
King.
Lionel, where are you, Lionel? We're about to go. Five, four, three, two, one.
They are off. He's asking how to do the actual chat. Ride.
Just
hear
Lionel mumbling to himself.
Yes, I heard an earphone groan then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't work with wireless headphones.
Yeah, it does.
Well, it doesn't work with my wireless headphone.
Oh.
Oh, that's a shame.
Bit annoying, isn't it?
Should have put my glasses on.
Oh. We're almost halfway.
The power meter's dropped out. I've been dropped again.
Oh, Tom.
Oh, no.
It sounds so distant.
Oh no!
Kerrison's not checking your training peaks later on.
Oh, wait for you. I'll meet
you by the Guggenheim.
Oh, amazing!
You're a chiseled specimen there, on me wheel.
Oh yeah, really good. That's a pretty accurate representation of what I currently look like, Rob.
Is it?
lost four kilos and I've got long, luxuriant hair.
You're an Adonis, aren't you, really?